Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're tackling a truly monumental work, a book that's more than just history, really. It's The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
It really is monumental. And you know, it's not just a book you read. It's an experience almost, a profound act of witness.
Yeah, witness is the right word. So why should you, our listener, care about this book today? It's heavy stuff.
It is heavy, no doubt, but its importance hasn't faded. It's essentially a collective testimony, a memorial for millions silenced by the Soviet state. And maybe more crucially, it stands as this timeless warning.
Warning about what, specifically?
About the terrible dangers of certain kinds of ideology, you know, the utopian ones that promise paradise, but, well, demand total control. And it shows just how fragile freedom can be when faced with systematic state lies.
It feels like it cuts through historical amnesia. Like, you can't forget after reading this.
Exactly. Solzhenitsyn really dismantled the whole Soviet narrative, exposing this vast hidden system, the Gulag, this continent of suffering.
Okay, so let's get into the man behind this incredible, frankly terrifying work. Solzhenitsyn himself, his authority doesn't come from research in a library, does it?
No, not at all. Alexander Solzhenitsyn lived from 1918 to 2008, and he became this towering moral voice. But that authority, that credibility, it was forged entirely through his own direct experience.
He wasn't always a dissident, though.
Far from it, initially. He was actually a decorated captain in the Red Army during World War II, fought bravely for the Soviet Union.
Right, which makes his later critique even more potent.
Definitely. So picture this. 1945, war is ending, he's a hero, and then he gets arrested by Ismir Ashaich, the counterintelligence agency.
For what? What was the actual crime?
It seems almost unbelievable now. He'd written some private letters to a friend, and in those letters, he made some veiled criticisms of Stalin. Didn't even use his name.
Just implied criticism.
Called him the man with the mustache. That was enough.
Wow. In a private letter. That's chilling.
And for that, 8 years. Sentenced to 8 years in the Gulag system under the notorious Article 58.
Article 58. We'll need to come back to that.
No.
So he lived the entire journey he documents.
The whole thing. Lubyanka prison in Moscow, then a Sharashka, which is a kind of special prison for intellectuals and scientists.
Wait, a Sharashka? Like an intellectual prison? That sounds bizarre.
It does, doesn't it? They used skilled prisoners, scientists, engineers like Solzhenitsyn, who was a mathematician, for state projects. Conditions were still bad, but it was different from the raw, hard labor camps like Ekibastus, where he also spent time. He saw multiple layers of the system.
Okay, so that experience, it makes his perspective incredibly unique. He wasn't just one thing, was he? It feels like he wore three hats.
That's a great way to put it. First, absolutely, he was the witness. His own story provides the narrative backbone, the undeniable authenticity. You feel it on every page.
Right, and second?
Second, and this is where it becomes almost heroic, he became a kind of secret historian. After he got out, he knew his story wasn't enough. So he spent years secretly, painstakingly collecting stories, testimonies from 227 other prisoners, other Zeks.
Wow, 227. While living under that regime.
Yes. Weaving their experiences into his own. He was basically building an archive for a history the state was actively trying to erase. The goal was to give voice to the silenced.
And the third hat.
He was a literary master. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970, remember? He took all this raw material, all this pain and fact, and crafted something entirely new. He called it an experiment in literary investigation.
Literary investigation. I like that. It's history, but with the power of great writing.
Precisely. That blend of rigorous detail and deep human insight, that's what gives the book its enduring power.
Okay, let's tackle the core argument then. Some people might say, okay, Stalin was brutal, the 30s were awful, but maybe the Gulag was just, you know, a terrible side effect, an anomaly. How does Solzhenitsyn respond to that? What's the book's main point, its central thesis?
Oh, this is absolutely crucial. His central argument is a fundamental challenge to the whole Soviet project. He argues very forcefully that the Gulag system, the secret police, the arrests, the camps, the forced labor herd, it was not an accident. It wasn't just a later distortion under Stalin.
Okay. So what was it then?
He says it was the logical, inherent, and necessary consequence of the Marxist-Leninist ideology the state was built on right from 1917.
Whoa. So not a bug, but a feature. baked in from the start.
Exactly. The ideology itself, by defining whole groups of people, classes, intellectuals, clergy as enemies, inherently required a mechanism for their removal and exploitation. The Gulag was that mechanism.
That connects directly to the title, doesn't it? The Archipelago.
It does. It's such a powerful metaphor. He saw that these thousands of camps spread across the vast Soviet territory weren't just isolated prisons. They formed a chain, a network of islands of suffering and archipelago.
Like a hidden continent built on slave labor and death, scattered within the supposedly free society.
Perfectly put, a hidden continent. And his goal, his massive undertaking across 3 volumes, 7 parts, covering nearly 40 years from 1918 to 1956, was to map it, to trace the journey of the typical victim.
A journey into hell, basically.
Pretty much.
So let's follow that journey. Volume 1 starts with how you get pulled in, right?
Yeah.
Part 1, the prison industry. The arrest itself.
Yes. He describes these relentless waves of arrests washing over the country. First, it was priests, intellectuals, opponents right after the revolution. Then farmers, the so-called kuleks during collectivization. Then loyal party members during Stalin's purges. Even soldiers returning from WWII like himself.
It sounds like a machine that constantly needed feeding.
It was. And the legal tool that fed it was that thing we mentioned earlier, Article 58.
Right, the political crime code.
Right.
What made it so effective for, well, for mass arrests?
Its deliberate vagueness. Article 58 covered counter-revolutionary activity, but that term was so broad, so undefined. Honestly, almost anything could be twisted to fit. A stray comment, knowing the wrong person, even just a suspicion, it essentially legalized paranoia.
So once they arrest you under Article 58, you go into interrogation. But it wasn't about finding truth, was it?
Not at all. The goal of interrogation wasn't discovery, it was confession. To break the prisoner's will and force them to sign off on whatever fabricated charges the state needed.
How? What methods did they use?
A brutal combination. Endless interrogation cycles, sleep deprivation for days, weeks sometimes, isolation, sensory deprivation, threats against family. Psychological torture, really, designed to shatter the individual.
Just relentless pressure.
Utterly relentless. And once broken, sentenced, they entered part 2, perpetual motion, the journey to the camps. This is where he uses that horrifying phrase.
The sewage disposal system.
Yes. It's grim, but accurate. He described how human beings were treated like waste products, crammed into these repurposed cattle cars, the Stolypin cars. Journeys could last weeks, months, across thousands of miles. People died just in transit.
It emphasizes the sheer scale, doesn't it? The logistics of moving millions of people like that.
The continental scale of the entire operation. It wasn't just a few camps here and there. It was a network covering a vast landmass.
Okay, so Volume 2 takes us inside the camps themselves. Part 3, the destructive labor camps. This is the core, right?
This is the heart of the archipelago, an encyclopedic description of camp life. He details infamous places like Kolyma in Siberia.
Known as the Pole of Cold and Cruelty.
Exactly. And massive, deadly projects like the White Sea-Baltic Canal, built by prisoners with primitive tools, freezing temperatures. The human cost was just catastrophic. Tens, maybe hundreds of thousands died building that canal alone.
And inside the camps, there was a hierarchy. It wasn't just guards and prisoners.
No, it was more complex. Solzhenitsyn highlights the crucial distinction between the political prisoners, the Article 58s like himself, and the common criminals, the professional thieves known as the Blatni.
And strangely, the administration often favored the thieves. Why would they do that?
It was a deliberate tactic of control. The Blatni were often violent and ruthless. The camp authorities used them unofficially to terrorize the political prisoners, who were seen as the real ideological threat. It kept the politicals divided, scared, and unable to organize effectively.
Just layer upon layer of cruelty.
It's hard to fathom, but then the book takes a turn, doesn't it? In part 4, The Soul and Barbed Wire, it shifts from just physical survival.
To moral survival. How do you stay human in that environment? The pressure must have been immense. To inform on others, to steal food.
Exactly. The daily moral compromises were soul-destroying for many, but this is where Solzhenitsyn finds his deepest insight. He observed that for some, not all, but some, this extreme suffering, it stripped away everything superficial.
Like a purification.
He uses that word. A kind of spiritual purification. Losing everything, status, possessions, illusions, forced a confrontation with the absolute core of existence, a morality. It's where he develops his most famous idea about good and evil.
We'll definitely come back to that. Skipping ahead towards the end, part 7, Stalin is gone. His death in 1953 didn't mean the gates just swung open, did it?
Absolutely not. The change was incredibly slow, grudging. The system had momentum, but cracks did appear. Solzhenitsyn documents the incredible bravery of the camp uprisings that happened after Stalin's death.
Like the Kangur Rebellion. That story is just unbelievable.
It really is. Prisoners at the Kangur camp actually took control for 40 days. They organized themselves, made demands for basic human rights. It was an incredible display of courage.
How did it end?
Tragically, the Soviet army eventually moved in with tanks and crushed the rebellion violently. But it sent a shockwave. It showed the spirit hadn't been entirely broken.
And even if you survived your sentence, you weren't truly free.
Mm-hmm.
There was still exile.
Yes. The system's reach extended beyond the wire. Former prisoners, Zeks, were often forbidden from living in major cities, forced into internal exile in remote areas, constantly monitored. The stigma, the lack of rights, it continued.
Okay, let's try to distill some key themes from this enormous, harrowing work. These feel less like historical points and more like universal lessons, right?
Very much so. The first, and maybe the central argument we discussed, is ideology as the engine of atrocity.
The idea that if you believe strongly enough in a future utopia, any action, no matter how cruel, becomes justified to get there.
Precisely. It provides the moral excuse, let's say, for mass violence.
Mm-hmm.
It allows people to stop seeing victims as human beings and start seeing them as enemies of the people, obstacles to progress, dehumanized categories. And that applies across the political spectrum historically.
A chilling thought. The second theme seems to be the corrosive power of the lie.
Absolutely fundamental. The entire Soviet system, as Solzhenitsyn shows, was built on lies. Forced confessions, show trials, falsified history, constant propaganda. This culture of dishonesty wasn't just top-down. It forced everyone into complicity.
It makes you think, doesn't it? About the smaller lies we might accept or participate in maybe in our workplaces or communities just to avoid conflict.
It's a crucial connection. Then there's perhaps his most famous insight. The line dividing good and evil runs through every human heart.
This is the really challenging one. He's saying the capacity for evil isn't just out there in the guards or the interrogators.
He realized it was potentially within himself, within everyone. It shatters simple us versus them thinking. Before judging others, he argues, you have to confront the potential darkness within your own heart. It's a radical call for self-awareness.
And that connects to the last theme, the complicity of ordinary people.
Yes. The Gulag system wasn't run by just a few monsters. It required millions of people playing their small parts. The neighbor who informs, the clerk who processes the papers, the train driver, the judge who looks away. People just doing their jobs.
It's a powerful warning against indifference, against thinking, it's not my problem.
Definitely. It highlights the danger of passive acceptance.
Solzhenitsyn's writing itself is just so powerful. He could condense so much into a few words.
He really could. The book is full of lines that just stop you in your tracks.
Let's share a couple. Maybe the most startling one is, bless you, present for having been in my life. How on earth do we understand that?
It sounds perverse, doesn't it? But he's not thanking the prison for the suffering itself. He's acknowledging that the extreme stripping away of everything, freedom, comfort, status, ego, forced a kind of spiritual confrontation and clarity he never would have found otherwise. It revealed essential truths.
Truths hidden by ordinary life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the one we touched on, the absolute moral core. The line separating good and evil passes not through states nor between classes, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts.
It's such a powerful rejection of ideology, isn't it? Putting the responsibility back on the individual.
Completely. It refutes the whole basis of class warfare or blaming entire groups. The struggle is internal, universal.
And one more, which feels like the motto for the entire book. One word of truth shall outweigh the whole world.
Mm. In a system built on pervasive lies, the simple act of telling the truth bearing witness, which was his mission with this book, becomes the most powerful form of resistance imaginable. It exposes the whole rotten structure.
So bringing this home for someone listening today, this history is overwhelming. How can we apply these lessons from the Gulag to our own lives, our own societies?
Well, the first is surely vigilance against dehumanizing ideology. We need to be alert to the language Solzhenitsyn identified. When groups start dividing the world into a simple us versus them, when opponents are labeled not just wrong, but evil as enemies, as less than human.
That's the warning sign.
That's the flashing red light. And watch out for any argument that says a noble goal justifies brutal methods. That logic is the gateway.
It also helps us understand what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, right?
Yeah.
That evil often isn't monstrous, it's bureaucratic.
Precisely. So much of the gulag functioned because people were just following orders, ticking boxes, doing their jobs. It's a reminder for all of us in any organization to maintain our own moral compass, to question, and sometimes to refuse to participate, even in small ways.
Which leads to the importance of individual moral courage.
Yes. Solzhenitsyn's own life and the stories he collected show the immense power of seemingly small acts. Refusing to repeat a slogan you don't believe, maintaining integrity when everyone around you is compromising. These acts preserve your own humanity, and collectively they can resist even oppressive systems.
And finally, it underlines the critical role of historical memory.
Absolutely. When the state controls the past, controls the narrative, it can commit atrocities with impunity, protecting a free press, supporting independent historians, preserving archives. These aren't academic exercises. They are essential acts of defense for a free society. We have to know what happened.
So wrapping this up, what's the one thing you personally learned or took away most strongly from revisiting this work?
For me, I think it's the stark realization that colossal evil isn't some alien invasion. It's a potential that lies dormant within human societies, even within individual hearts. And it gets activated by ideology, by fear, and by widespread indifference. The sheer systemic nature of the terror, it wasn't random, it was the system.
Yeah, that systemic point is terrifying. What surprised me most, I think, was the counterpoint to the horror, the resilience, the moments of transcendence. The book is an absolute chronicle of suffering, but somehow it's also a guide to the survival of the human spirit.
That's beautifully put.
And the ultimate power of truth, just telling the truth, bearing witness, it somehow feels like it did, in the end, outweigh the lies and the power of the state.
One word of truth.
Indeed. A profoundly important, deeply challenging, but necessary read.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.